You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In Demon Fish Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks, the Washington Post's national environmental reporter Juliet Eilperin attempts to explain our fascination with the ocean's most frightening predators by exploring the places where humans and sharks come face to face. The book is published by Pantheon Books, and I'm happy to have Juliet Eilperin here with me today. Thank you for coming on. This is our Shark Day.
Exactly.
Here at the Leonard Lopate Show.
Never too soon for a summer shark day.
We don't have enough for a week. Well, we actually probably have enough for months, given what you've written in the book. Your book is largely about the way that people view sharks, which has changed over time. How did ancient societies think about sharks?
Many of them worshipped sharks, but had fairly nuanced views of them. In other words, they saw them as potentially a force for good or evil, depending on whether they were your allies or not. So, for example, the Hawaiians had shark deities. They, interestingly, for example, credit a shark god with inventing surfing. And
sure,
also,
that's cool.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So why not have a shark god create it?
That would look great on a surfboard, a shark surfing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I know. Why wasn't I able to spot that for the book? So so what they really had is this idea that sharks would be allied with individual families or communities, and they could either reward them or mete out punishment to their enemies, which obviously sharks can do.
So the reason why sharks might have been looked at by older societies as a source of danger is pretty apparent. Right. But how do they become identified with creation?
Interestingly, there are these different creation stories. And for example, Papua New Guineans have a whole creation story which involves their god Moroa, who creates sharks in the way that their god created everything on Earth, the way, you know, we have that in many religions. But I think part of it is they saw them as powerful and saw themselves connected to them in a way that we often don't today. So
sure.
Given that they were spending time at sea and saw them functioning in the ocean, they somehow had the sense that they were part of their world.
And the Papua New Guineans still worship sharks, do they not?
They do. There's a group of shark callers, one of whom I spent time with, who see sharks as directly related to their ancestors, that they are both descended from them and that their ancestors can communicate with them through
mm-hmm.
sharks.
Oh, and what is shark calling entail exactly?
It entails a single man, and they're all men, who mm-hmm. would go out in a canoe, take a coconut.
And by single, you mean alone or unmarried?
Alone.
Okay.
Actually, yes, you can be married or unmarried.
Right.
And so they go out. So a person would go out in a canoe,
right.
take a coconut rattle, which they shake rhythmically both in the ocean and against the canoe, which basically our sense is that it sounds like a school of fish that are in trouble that would attract the sharks.
Sure.
And then they actually have a specific canoe.
Many of times I've heard a rattle, and I'm like, is that a school of fish?
Right, right.
Yeah,
you think that and you're going about your day-to-day business.
Right.
And so the shark hopefully approaches, and they basically capture it in a kind of a noose.
Made out of rope
and wood with something that would kind of secure the shark as you're tightening the rope,
mm-hmm.
and then club it. And you really have man-on-shark combat in a canoe, while in this tiny canoe. And they beat the shark and then pull it up and bring it back to shore for the whole village to eat.
And so the shark would then be consumed?
Exactly. The shark's consumed. And they would keep they have the option of having the best part of the body that they want, the shark collar.
The shark collar.
And then everyone else eats the rest. And then they keep the fins. And they used to put them up in their special huts and kind of it would be their trophy. But now they're actually part of a global shark trade, a shark fin trade. And they often sell that part.
Right. Well, they're hugely in demand, shark fins. And why?
Basically, there's an Asian delicacy called shark's fin soup, which is very popular in China as well as many other countries in Asia. And it's something that's now kind of the essential dish for a wedding or an important business meal. And so as a result, they're targeting sharks across the globe for their fins, just the fins, which are the valuable part.
Mm-hmm.
And they make noodles out of them, which actually have no flavor, but are the essential ingredient if you're going to serve this
dish. Have you had shark's fin soup?
I did. I tried it and it was quite tasty, but it turns out that's because they put a lot of other good flavoring, including chicken and pork, in it.
Does the shark fin add a texture to the soup?
Slightly, although frankly, mm-hmm. because it's so pricey, you had to really hunt for the tiny, tiny little gelatinous noodles. But it does have a specific texture that people like.
So essentially it's a status symbol.
Absolutely.
It's a status food.
It's a status food.
And what I thought was interesting in your book was connecting how more and more people in China are attaining reaching a certain level of status where they feel they need to have it, driving this huge demand.
Right. What's really interesting is shark's fin soup was politically rehabilitated, in fact, in China, because essentially it had been since the 11th century something that elites ate. And then under Mao, it was unacceptable because it was associated with a class society. So it was really only in the late 80s and early 90s, once people, when they reintroduced capitalism and started doing that, that it became something that people thought was good for everyone to eat and really was important to show that you've earned enough money that you can buy it.
And what has been the effect on the shark population?
What's incredible is that scientists estimate that up to 73 million sharks a year worldwide are killed just for their fins, and that doesn't include the sharks that are killed accidentally or targeted for different
Because I've accidentally killed a few sharks.
I would have pegged you as an accidental. Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes I'm out there in my canoe.
Rattling the
as you do,
coconuts.
And I got the noose, and all of a sudden, whoops! But I don't do those horrible things that you see, where they just cut off the fin and throw the rest of the shark.
That's what makes you better. That you can do it.
But that happens.
Yeah. So I mean, that's really
it's an incredibly wasteful fishery.
It's unbelievable. So basically, they just slice off the fins and toss the rest of the bodies in to sink, and obviously, this shark can't survive, but it's used for no other purpose.
I'm talking with Juliet Eilperin about her book "Demon Fish: Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks." This is WNYC and WNYC.org. My name is John Hodgman. I'm filling in for Leonard Lopate today. It's summertime. It's the time of the year when my family traditionally watches the movie Jaws. What did Jaws do for the reputation of sharks in the United States?
It really, I think, cemented the idea of sharks as serial killers and as animals that could get anyone at any time when they entered the ocean. It's not that we didn't fear them before, and it really did what was masterful with Peter Benchley is he did tap into this primordial fear that we have of sharks, but it made it seem like they could be a threat to anyone the moment you dipped your toe into the water.
I mean, the shark in Jaws kind of became a different kind of cultural deity, in a sense, like a killing machine.
Absolutely.
And a representative of perilous nature.
Right. It really gave the sense that you had something to fear and that, again, it ascribed an intentionality to sharks, which they obviously don't have. But in all of our minds, it came this idea that this thing is actually out to get us. It actually was equated with that.
If you are to believe in Jaws 2, it wants revenge.
Right. And if you go all the way to Jaws 4, it will even follow you to the Bahamas from New England.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's an angry shark. With a lot of time on its hands.
And which can be resurrected. So that gives the deity, too, because they keep killing the shark and it comes back.
But sharks are loners. I mean, they do have – this was something interesting in the book that I read. They don't travel in schools and make a rattling sound.
Usually not. Some of the smaller sharks do in different
– Well, we're not talking about small sharks.
Okay.
No one wants to hear about small sharks on Shark Day.
It's the big sharks. And why, if you're a big gray white, you don't want someone else competing for food. So forget it.
So you try to seek out you're not, you know, waging revenge on a small town sheriff.
Right.
You're trying to seek out a territory where there are no more other great whites out there.
Right. And in fact, one of the cool fun facts is that if two great whites are together and they're going after, say, the same elephant seal, they'll engage in tail slaps in kind of who's the biggest and baddest shark. And whoever wins the tail slap contest, that's the one that gets to eat the
seal. Do they ever hunt other sharks? Do they ever hunt each other?
They do sometimes kill each other in different forms.
But by accident.
Exactly. It's, you know, the noose, the rattle, right, it comes together and who knows.
Exactly. What makes sharks different from fish?
Well, they actually are fish. So they are fish, but they're different from bony fish in two kind of primary ways. One is that rather than have a bony skeleton, they have this cartilaginous skeleton. Okay. So that's one of the reasons why they get, you know, they're a coveted food item in Asia. And they don't have swim bladders the way that other fish do. So it actually is one of the things that can help their survival, because you can even pull up a shark and toss it back in, and it has a much higher chance of surviving than, say, a fish that you had done the same thing with.
Well, I'm not sure I understand the mechanism of the swim bladder that would allow
apparently it to... the swim bladder explodes when because of the pressure when it goes it happens by accident and these
right
things,
that's
these
why things they happen. Say always wait 10 minutes before swimming after a meal
it's
I thought so
clearly
Should we be afraid of great white sharks? Is that a meaningful fear in our lives?
It's a legitimate fear in the sense that if one is in the water with a great white, that's not really what you want to have happen,
right?
Because they can kill you by accident just as you have killed many sharks by accident. So,
it
goes
both
ways.
I don't want to brag. Let's just get back to sharks.
But there are a few species that do pose a legitimate threat, including bull sharks, tiger sharks, and great whites. But we clearly have this disproportionate fear when you think of the fact that you're 11 times more likely to be killed by fireworks, 60,000 times more likely to die from the flu in the United States than be killed by a shark. So it's a little out of proportion.
I remember shark attacks being the main story of the summer of 2001 before something else happened that really distracted us and sort of refocused our attention.
Absolutely. There were
what real danger is.
Exactly. Yeah. There were a few shark attacks that happened in that summer. And in fact, you had politicians like the then Governor Gilmore of Virginia created a shark committee to kind of try to figure out what one can do about it. But, again, worldwide in the past decades, it's averaged between 4 and 5 people a year who die worldwide from sharks.
Now, you have swum with sharks. Isn't that correct? You opened the book Swimming with Sharks in Bimini. Is that right?
I did. I jumped into the water and swam with a bunch of reef sharks in Bimini and had a few different adventures, most of them outside a cage, just swimming with ones that aren't going to
go out. So you weren't in a cage like Richard Dreyfuss.
Exactly. I was only in a cage off South Africa with the great white because I knew that one doesn't want to get in the water with the great white without a little bit of protection.
And how close did that great white shark get to your cage?
Pretty close because the shark was going after a tuna head that was being dangled on a rope nearby without a noose. But I would say, a few feet, say, 4 or 5 feet.
So when you're free swimming with sharks, what kind of sharks were we talking about then?
So it's a whole range. In Bimini, it was some of these reef sharks that
And please focus on the big sharks because I don't care about the little.
Well, the big sharks.
I'd love to hear about the little sharks too, though. I'm just being
now the big shark, and the biggest shark that I swam with is the biggest fish in the sea, which is whale sharks.
All right, so that's a very confusing name.
It's true. That's because scientists don't often know what they're talking about, I have to be honest. It does filter feed like a whale, so that's really why they call it, but it's not a whale, it's a shark.
And how big are we talking about?
They get roughly the size of a school bus, so the ones I was with were, in the 20 feet.
Do people, are they friendly?
They're friendly in that they don't really have scary jaws that can eat you.
Right. They might filter you.
Exactly. They might suck
to discomfort.
You in with the plankton and then you'd go through that processing and you wouldn't want that
to
happen.
No, thank you.
And the one I was swimming with almost ran me over. But again, it was by accident. So I got out of the way and,
What is it like to be in the presence of a creature that huge that does not care about you?
See, that's, you mentioned a really interesting point, which is one of the best parts about swimming with sharks is they're indifferent to you. And I think that's kind of incredible.
Basically, I think that's probably what makes them more scary than anything else.
Maybe. Although in some ways, it ultimately ended up calming me down because I basically thought, I'm not what they're focused on. And so I can just watch them do their thing.
Right.
And in fact, really get into that. So,
and when you say indifferent, it wasn't that they were not aware that you were there. They just...
Right. It's just you're not their focus. They're basically moving along their way. And of course, if you ended up really colliding with them, there would be something. But basically, they're just going through the ocean.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how sharks do sense their surroundings. We know that they love rattles.
Right.
They go crazy for it. You also talk about them smelling in stereo.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things, and this is a thing that scientists have recently discovered, that they have such an incredible, sense of smell. People always talk about they can detect a drop of blood in the water in the Olympic sized swimming pool, those big sharks that you love.
Not that I love them so much. They're just great for ratings.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That their tracking is so sophisticated that basically they will smell a scent coming with one nostril and it'll hit the second nostril just a fraction of a second later. And during that time, they're able to target the direction from which the scent is coming. And that allows them to be such great predators that they can actually track it that way.
And scientists are discovering a lot of new things about sharks, largely because they didn't really care for a long time. Isn't that right?
Right. The interesting thing is they haven't had commercial value historically. In fact, there are these campaigns early on where the agriculture department was trying to figure out ways we could, encourage people to eat or catch sharks in different ways. And so as a result, people didn't study them. And it's really only in recent decades that you've seen a burgeoning shark scientific project that's really been going on.
And what have we learned that's been surprising to us since we actually started paying attention to these creatures?
One of the most surprising things is that they spend a lot more time closer to us, close to shore, than we would think.
Right, because they're angry and they're hunting us and they want revenge.
Either that or, you know, like Willie Sutton, they're going where the money is, so they're going to where the seals are. So if the seals are hanging right off the, you know, California coast or right out off of, you know, the Cape, they're going to go there.
Right. And with a whale shark, for example, where are we going to find one of those?
Often you can find them. They do regular migration patterns off the Yucatan, near Mexico, and then also Belize. So those are some of the places. But they also are off Australia. So there's a huge.
So they're very dispersed.
Yeah, exactly. They like to get around.
And do people ride them?
You know, occasionally, but then they feel bad afterwards that they've done that. So there's a great the woman who's known as the Shark Lady, Jeannie Clark, from Moat Marine Lab, and she did ride a whale shark and loved it. But then she says, now that I know, you know, more about them, I'd never do it again.
Well, when did she ride it, and what did she learn? Maybe it's not right to hitch a ride with a creature that doesn't
exactly.
know.
Exactly. I think she got greater respect for it. But so it was decades ago. And she also went extremely far from her dive boat. And I think one of the things you learn is that if you ride a whale shark, you know, you're going to end up pretty far from the boat that you need to get
on.
How
fast can they go?
It's not super fast. It's basically, I think it's something like a mile or so an hour. But, you know, that still gets you a far piece.
And by riding, she simply hung on?
She literally apparently hung on.
There was not a special saddle involved or anything else?
Not that I know of.
So even though we've just started looking at sharks a little bit more closely, they've been around for a long time. I'd venture to guess hundreds of years. Would that be about right?
And you're a little shy given that we're talking about roughly 400 million. But, you know, really, almost it's almost the same thing.
Numbers.
Not how
long
my specialty.
Sharks have been around for a long time.
Exactly.
In a relatively unchanged state.
Exactly. What's interesting is that they developed, say, a couple hundred million years before dinosaurs, roughly, and they...
Before dinosaurs?
Before dinosaurs, and yet they've stuck around, showing them that they obviously have done something right.
Wow.
Yeah.
What about Megalodon?
Megalodon, sadly not with us, was...
Are you sure sadly is the adverb you want to use there? That was a big... shark, right? A super predator.
An enormous, the ancestor of the great white, but with a bite force that was something like 10 times, and I think it was 180 times the bite force of an African lion, something like that. So, you know, you definitely wouldn't want to run into a megalodon.
So how did a creature like megalodon disappear when sharks remain sort of unchanged for hundreds of millions of years? What happened to megalodon?
That's a good question. Perhaps that should be the subject of my next book, but what happened to the megalodon? But as far as I know, I mean, I think that partially, you know, you had changes in the ocean environment. I mean, again, there were basically ancestors to the modern day sharks evolved more. It was more than 200 million years ago, but not as far back. So clearly, you know, something.
You know, numbers mean nothing to me. So I'm putting them all together at this
point. Right. Or I could just make them up, which gives me a lot of freedom.
I'm speaking with Juliette Eilperin, the future author of What Happened to Megalodon? And the current author of Demon Fish Travels Through the Hidden Worlds of Sharks. I was speaking with Amy Sedaris earlier about rabbit care. Can we keep sharks as pets?
You know, some people do, and that's not a great idea, is the answer.
Right.
So there's a huge, for example, illegal pet trade in leopard sharks, which are the kind of more warm and fuzzy. They could actually fit into your aquarium and tank, at least initially, and they look nice and they sit at the bottom. But basically, it's, you know. I would give up on that.
And so trade in sharks for that purpose is illegal.
Yeah, so that's illegal. There was actually a sting that was done for a leopard peddling shark ring where they would be fishing them off the coast of California and trading them around, and that they were caught by the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Well, what other legal protections do sharks enjoy if they're being hunted at such a voracious rate at this time? What can be done, or what is being done, to stop it?
It's a really good question. Basically, we have some decent protections here in the United States that it's not, you know, it depends. There are only three sharks that internationally have protections, which they go for the big sharks like you, the basking
the
whale
ones
sharks.
That people care about.
Exactly, and the great whites. But there's an emerging shark lobby that's pushing for stricter, particularly international trade protections are probably the shark's best bet, because if they got... you know, all the countries to agree. There are many individual countries. The Bahamas is about to outlaw commercial fishing of sharks because they recognize for their tourism industry it's better to have them around. But, you know, basically what's happening is that you need global protections to cut down on those international fin trade.
And do you think that these laws will be effective? I mean, it's one thing to pass along a law, but there's a harder time enforcing it if you have a huge population of the world that wants to eat these fins.
Absolutely. And that's why probably, you know, a change in Japan would be critical to really cut down on the fin trade. But, you know, one thing that we're seeing even in the United States, for example, is on the West Coast, Washington has outlawed the sale and possession of shark fins. Oregon has passed it in both chambers, is waiting to get it signed by the governor. And California has passed it in the assembly and probably will finalize it by the end of the year.
Well, so I don't know a lot about numbers, but that's like 10,000 people who might want to eat that compared to millions of people in Asia.
It's true. But, you know, for example, California boasts the two of the largest Chinese food markets outside of Asia. So it does, you know, it does both send kind of a message and also could have some effect on the shark trade.
And not to be monstrous, but what would happen in the world if sharks were hunted to extinction or near extinction?
It essentially would be very bad for the oceans, which is why people might want to care about
it. Right, because I don't think people appreciate that they're really in connection with the whole food chain in the ocean. They think of them as loner, predator, mischief maker, vengeance seekers.
Exactly.
Who probably should be done away with.
Right, and so that's the popular perception. But in reality, when you look at it, what I think is so interesting is that they do a lot of functions. They're the garbage collector. They take out the weak, the sick, and, you know, and those who deserve vengeance and to be wrought upon them. And in addition, as the top predator in the ocean, they really help regulate the food chain by keeping other populations in check.
What are there any predators besides humans that eat sharks?
You know, I think on certain occasions, I mean, they killer whales, I think, have tangled with them from time to time. And other sharks can often, again, you know, get in fights with them and wreak havoc. And I don't know whether giant squid ever have confrontations, but I certainly have not been able to witness that.
Your previous book was Fight Club Politics. We've talked a little bit about your future book, Megalodon. but you moved from politics to shark hunting.
Exactly.
What are the similarities between the two?
Well, you know, I like to think that your average politician in some ways is like sharks, perhaps not the most redeeming moral figure, but fairly, for the most part, harmless and, you know, plays a function in our world and therefore, you know, deserves to stick around. Although, you know, I think you could probably make a better argument for sharks than some of our politicians.
And Congressperson Finn makes an amazing soup, I have to say.
Unbelievable when you add the chicken and the pork.
I've been speaking with Juliet Alperin about her book, Demon Fish, Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks. It's been published by Pantheon, and she'll be reading and signing books tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at Word Bookstore at 126 Franklin Street in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.